Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, as you were, with interest rates, but should the Bank of England have cut them? Also today, what to do if you're buying a home and it gets downvalued? Bungalow wars, downsizers and young families are battling it out as prices soar. Are energy firms trying to trick us into getting smart meters? And Wetherspoons, are you a lover or a hater? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, warm welcome to Lee, warm welcome to Simon. Simon, I think this episode is on you because I'm jet-lagged. And Lee Boyce, congratulations, is a new father, is a father again. You're always a father. How do you say that? I don't know. But Lee Boyce has just had a baby. Well, his wife has had a baby. Oh, goodly. This was not the smooth introduction that I'd hoped, Lee. But congratulations, nonetheless. Are you sleeping?
Thanks, George. That's very kind. Yes, sleeping much better than daughter one. Daughter two seems to be getting a bit faster. So, yeah, thanks for the congrats. Good to be back on the pod.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It gets better, Lee. Number three. That's where the real beauty lies.
I don't even know how to respond to that, Georgie.
You're just like, oh, not right now, Georgie. Not
actually, as one of four children, I don't have four children, but as one of four children, I'm the eldest of four. And knowing a friend who has four as well, actually, it's number four where it gets easier. You just basically let them do whatever you want, and if the older siblings are old enough, you can just palm it off on them half the time anyway.
Simon, I thought it was brave talking to Lee about a third one. Now you're talking about a fourth one. Give the poor lad a break. Right, let's get back to the pod, shall we? Welcome to you both. First, the Bank of England decided to hold the base rate for the sixth time in a row this week. It's been at 5.25% since September last year. But should they have been bold? Made a cut? What does it mean for our mortgages and savings? When will a move come? And in what direction? Consensus says down, but could it go up? So, welcome to you both, Simon, first. Not exactly unexpected, but why another hold?
Not exactly unexpected. That is pretty accurate there. Although, behind the curtain moment here, we get some of this rate stuff ready ahead of the decision. Because you literally can't write that much stuff in like 1 minute and then try to publish it just after midday. And when I said in our morning meeting yesterday, well, we got the rates today, but pretty much nailed on for a hold, aren't we? So we'll be fine there. I was given this look by Mr. Boyce and this wavering of in his voice saying, So I don't know. I think somebody had some doubt just that we might, you know, suddenly have to do an awful lot of work very quickly. But it wasn't.
No,
it was a hold. We know what a hold means. What was interesting was that we then had more details from the Bank of England. We also had the rate decision and the Monetary Policy Committee report. And we had Mr. Bailey giving his press conference. And people have been reading into that lots of stuff since. But to set the picture, the Bank of England, 7-2 to hold, 2 for a cut, 7 for a hold. Doesn't potentially reflect the general mood out there amongst economists, analysts, commentators, where I think there's more of a 50-50 split on the hold rates and cut them now. And there are some people saying cut them now. You've got to get ahead of the curve. You've got to cut them
Why?
Now. Because to give the economy a boost, the idea is that the economy is slowing. It's not doing that well. Inflation is already falling. Inflation could fall straight through the target and then go low. Businesses are suffering from higher rates. The mortgage market has seen rates tickle up, which we'll go into in a minute. That's slowing down the housing market. And we could just generally do with just a little bit of a boost that we get from cutting rates. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got people saying, it's taken us this long to get back to normal. This is normal. 0.5% is not normal. We don't want to go anywhere near there. Inflation is coming down. it's not coming down really, really quickly, you know, enough for us to make us think that we need to cut rates right now. The housing market, yes, it's not doing great, but it's not doing awful. It's proved to be much more resilient than we thought. Generally speaking, people's finances have proved to be more resilient than we thought, although some people are taking real pain off the back of this. Cutting rates by a small amount won't really make a difference anyway. And actually, we just need to get used to the situation, and it's better that we just stick where we are. As you can see, the voting intentions of the Bank of England at the moment are currently 7-2, but that could shift around. And then Andrew Bailey came out yesterday and said a rate cut at the Monetary Policy Committee's next meeting in June was neither ruled out nor a fait accompli.
Right.
Now you can see what he's doing there, can't you? He said, it's likely that we will need to cut bank rates over the coming quarters, possibly more so than currently priced into market rates. And at which point he basically lobbed everything out the window. So he said, it's not ruled out. It's not a fait accompli. We'll make our mind up when we come to it. Calm down, everyone. And then promptly said, we might need to cut them more than the market thinks. So everyone went, whoa, rate cut-a-rama. And then we had GDP figures showing that the UK is out of its extremely brief recession. The GDP figures arrived this morning and grew much faster than expected. So maybe that poured cold water on the rate cuts. Who knows? I personally think, and I think this is true in the UK and in the US, that the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, would much rather not be cutting rates. They would much rather stick around at this level for some time. And I wouldn't expect lots of rate cuts. I think maybe we will see one this year, but I wouldn't be surprised if we only saw one this year. And I think whilst Mr. Bailey said what he said, he's also got to convince all the other people on the MPC in order to get them to vote for a cut. And he does look a little bit, well, he does sound a little bit gung-ho at times on this, considering it wasn't that long ago that he was warning us that we really did need to keep a lid on inflation.
Lee, were you just being a sort of cautious, cynical, sensible journalist there, having that in the back pocket that, you know, let's just not imagine it's going to be absolutely guaranteed nailed on? Or did you genuinely think a cut might be coming this week?
I'm an odds man, Georgie. So I was reading City editor Mike Sheen's piece, the previewing it of could we really see a cut this week? And in there, the kind of market pricing is suggesting that there's a 50% chance of base rate falling to 5% after the MPC's meeting yesterday and on the 20th of June. So my kind of spidey senses were saying, well, there is a smaller possibility that this could happen compared to recent months, where I just think it has been completely nailed on. I think what's probably, I kind of, yeah, it was fairly nailed on, but thinking ahead to the next meeting, I think what's going to be crucial is the inflation reading, which is due out on the 21st of May. That's going to factor in quite a big drop in energy prices, which could have quite a big influence on where inflation sits. I mean, it was at 3.4% in March. There's quite a high chance that it's going to get to 2 point something. And then I think the pressure grows a little bit more. Obviously, the target inflation is 2%. There might be a bit more pressure to kind of say, well, hey, ho, look, we've got inflation under control. It's time to start cutting rates. But of course, what we're seeing across the pond, we are heavily influenced by what, you know, happens in America and what goes on in America. And they've had a bit more stubborn inflation in recent times, which means the Fed doesn't look like it's in any rush to cut rates at the moment. So it was just, I was being a little bit overly cautious. We've always got to have that kind of mindfulness of, hold on, just what if they do completely throw something, you know, curveball? You know, we're gonna have to get something ready quite quickly. So, you know, have to tell the reporters to be ready and primed if that happens. I think seeing that two people voted for a cut this time round suggests that the music is changing slightly, but I think the crucial thing will be this inflation reading, which comes week after next.
Lovely peek behind the curtain there, Lee, of what you guys are up to and what you do. So we wait to see on this one. Just a quick word, doesn't have to be quick actually, Lee, take as long as you want, but savings, let's go there. What does it mean for savings? What are the best deals? Every time we get a pause, does it just mean that everything just stays the same?
Not really. We're seeing a kind of world of savings now in which the best deals have been falling away and peeling away for some time. Now, you know, getting 5% interest on your savings is starting to become a more tricky endeavor. In fact, this week I had a email from Zopa, who I've got a cash ISA with, an easy access one, cutting the rate on that. It looks like there's quite a lot of rate cuts, left, right, and center, to be quite frank with you. So we're, you know, it's not completely linked to base rate, but of course it is in a large way because we've seen rates, savings rates rise as the base rate has risen. But we've had, you know, a number of pauses in a row now. A lot of that had already been priced in. There's been a lot of competition in the savings world. A lot of it is banks, building societies have a target of how much money they want to pull in. They hit the target, they pull the rate. Now the competition has been very, very strong, and people, banks, building sites, have been able to pull in money much quicker than they had been in recent years, just because rates are way more attractive than what they were. But the experts are kind of saying, you know, this isn't going to have a great impact in rates. We've kind of hit a point where they've been dropping and then they're kind of plateauing at the moment. And what happens now in this kind of stage of play is that you'll get one of the smaller players quite often going straight to the top of the best buy because they want to fill their coffers for a certain reason. So, you know, some of the best deals still offer, you can still get an easy access 5.02%. That's with Oxford Bank. You can still get 5.18% on a 1 year fix. We've got a notice account actually that you can sign up for. You can find on our website from a company called Prosper, which is a 365-day notice account. So essentially, you can open the account and give notice on day one, and it's essentially a 1 year fix. That's at 5.6% rate. That actually completely trumps anything else that's currently on offer. Mm-hmm. But there's still, these rates aren't as attractive as they once were, and we always hold up that NS&I 6.2% rate that we saw at the tail end of last year as really that was the peak. That was the real moment where rates peaked. But the good news is there's 1,364 savings accounts to beat inflation, which that's I good. Think is you know, it's pretty good, isn't it? You know,
decent, yeah. Just got to remember to move around and make sure you take advantage of those, eh?
Exactly that. So, yeah, it's an interesting outlook. I think that, yeah, much of what we've seen now is probably, we're not going to see like a glut of like great new rates, you know, come into play. But I think that people have found themselves being able to get a much better return than what they previously did. Also, I realised that I said that inflation was at 3.4% just a minute ago. It's at 3.2%, isn't it? Okay, I'm correcting myself as I go along. But yeah, I think that a lot of people did open accounts a year ago. Lots of 1 year fixes, lots of 1 year fixed cash ISAs, and we're starting to get to that crossover point now where you might not quite get a rate as good as you did this time last year. But it's still nonetheless going to be inflation.
Righto. Simon, I move over to you for mortgages. Again, same question. Do the pause mean no change for mortgages?
Yes. And actually, before we go on to that, I should mention that podcast listeners might be interested in quite an interesting savings account that we've managed to secure as an exclusive for This Is Money Readers this week.
Nice.
It's with the savings and investing platform called Prosper. And it is a quirky one. It's a 365-day notice account, but it comfortably beats the best one-year fixes, and it pays 5.6%. Now, what's interesting about this is that most notice accounts, which are accounts where you tend to get a higher rate because you have to give a lot of warning that you want to take your money out, operate on a much shorter notice period, you know, 30 days, 60 days, even 90 days. 365 days is a really long time, but you could use this as a sort of equivalent to a one-year account by opening it and then giving notice immediately. The best one-year fixes are about 5.1%. This is 5.6%. The thing you need to know, though, is that the rate on this tracks the Bank of England base rate. So the pay rate is currently 0.35% above the Bank of England base rate. Obviously, base rate's going to have to be cut roughly twice before you get to the level of the best one-year fixes. So if you think it's only going to be cut twice in the next year, then you could get something that matches the best fixes. If you think it's not going to be cut as much as that, maybe it's going to stick for longer, then you could beat the best one-year fixes. But you're taking a gamble because, of course, it could be cut more than that. But anyway, it's an interesting one. And if you want to know more about it, go to thisismoney.co.uk/savings, where you can also sign up to our savings alerts, where we tell people by email about the new best savings deals first. So you find out about the great rates first. Onto mortgages, mm-hmm. as you asked. Well, if people want to find out more about what's been going on with mortgage rates, I would say go back and listen to last week's podcast where we talked about them in lots of depth. But they've been tickling up recently. It looks like interest rate forecasts, banks, building societies, everyone got a little bit ahead of themselves, thought interest rates were going to come down much more. Money markets did. That influences fixed mortgage rate pricing. Now everybody has reset their expectations. Don't expect rates to come down by as much as they did, which is reflected in interest rates going back up. We've seen a bit more activity in the housing market as well. So banks and building societies are feeling that they can squeeze rates up a bit because they had also been cutting rates in order to try and stimulate demand because there'd been such a slump in people wanting to buy homes last year. It's been a bit more positive this year, although we've had a few reports out recently showing that that kind of early year spring rush has sort of fizzled out as April has arrived. I mean, because prices are still very high and mortgage rates are high and it makes it harder for people to buy. So I would probably not expect mortgage rates to be coming down substantially over the course of the year, mm-hmm. unless we obviously get more rate cuts than expected, or all of a sudden we start getting a lot of noise that there's going to be more rate cuts than expected. Mm-hmm. But neither would I expect them to go up substantially unless we get some kind of, you know, inflation panic or some other freak out that, you know, the market might have. So I think they'll probably roughly stay around about where they are.
Mm. I'd never rule out the latter, though, to be honest. I mean, who knows nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you look back at them now, those two freak outs that we had in the mortgage market in, like, they were both within the same 12-month period, you know. They're a bit further away now. But you had the Liz Truss mini budget where you had a proper freak out after that. And then everything calmed down and rates came right down. And then you had the inflation mini panic last spring and summer, which is the one that looks even madder now because there was almost no need for it or reason for it whatsoever. It was a proper freak out. At least the Liz Truss one, you could kind of point the finger at Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng and go, well, guys, what were you thinking? The one last year was basically just a bit of a panic about inflation being higher than people thought it was going to be and not coming down as fast. And everything went, wah!
Yeah.
That's a technical term.
I was going to say that is the technical term for it, isn't it? Right, we're going to stick with housing here, because what to do if the home you're buying gets downvalued? You've been looking into this because you've got to read a question about it. So my husband and I are buying our first home. They found something they really liked. They made an offer, managed to agree a below asking price. But the mortgage valuation just came back, said the property was £40,000, 10% less than what they were buying it for. So the bank won't lend them as much as they initially thought. Both the estate agent and the mortgage broker told us there are lots of down valuations happening at the moment. They've had no luck negotiating with the seller. So what should they do? Before we get there, what exactly are down valuations? How do they come about? Lee, do you want to take that?
Yeah, so when you have an offer accepted on a house, the surveyor will go and check it out and make sure that the bank, on behalf of the bank or the lender, to make sure that they're happy with the sum of money you're paying for that property. And what happens sometimes is that the surveyor disagrees about the price that has been agreed, usually set by an estate agent. But of course, as a seller, it's down to you to kind of price a property and accept whichever offer you deem fit. But what can happen and does happen probably more frequently than what you realise is, you know, they don't match the same valuation. And there's a whole reasons for this, but a lot of it will be down to nervousness, especially house price confusion at the moment, kind of not clear quite what direction prices are going. In terms of, they then worry that if they give you the money that you're asking for, the property might not be worth what it's worth, and they might not recoup it if things go south. And it could be incredibly disappointing, especially if you've had an offer accepted. You know, some people house hunt for a very long time. It's not a simple process, you know, trying to tick the boxes of your kind of buying criteria. And then you find somewhere and you think it's all going through smoothly. And then it's almost like the first hurdle, surveyor says, it's not worth that. I think the kind of sometimes a bit of frustration on this, and having been on, I haven't had a down valuation, say, but I remember when we bought our current home, the seller sort of said the surveyor came round and was gone within sort of a couple of minutes. It was just as simple as that.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not saying that that's the case for every single report and surveyor out there. And perhaps they turned up and said, yep, actually, the location, where this is, everything, this worth this amount of money. But I think sometimes it's kind of, it can be a bit of a confusion as to being told that, you know, actually, this is worth 40 grand less than what you're paying for it. And then it panics you. You're kind of, oh, well, I am
Yeah.
paying for this. And, you know, there is that kind of feeling sometimes that homes are being overpriced and the estate agents are probably going a bit harder than what's necessary. But at the end of the day, it's agreeing what you think it's worth. But, you know, lender has to be cautious. It's a big sums of money involved, 10% deposit mortgage. It's a lot of money on the hook for the lender. So there is a kind of a bit of balance here. You know, you can't just expect the lender to definitely give you the money that you're asking for, even if you can afford it.
Quite, but this seems quite a lot lower. I mean, they said that they managed to get some money off the asking price. Apparently, the estate agent said, "Oh, you've got a great deal here," which, I mean, I don't know the estate agent, so whatever. But, you know, to then be 40,000 below the below asking price, Simon, whose fault is this? And what do you do? What should they do? What are their options?
Well, I mean, firstly, you can challenge it. And when you're challenging it, what you need to look at is what the valuer is going to look at. It's all about comparables. It's all about similar properties that have sold for prices that are higher, the same recently. Ideally, there'll be some, you know, in the same street, in the same location or around the corner. But you can go a bit broader than that. You go, right, okay, in this town, you know, three bedroom family properties usually go for X, and on this part of town it's more desirable, etc. You can put all of that information forward, but you do have to remember that the person who's done the valuation, there's a surveyor who's done this valuation. The surveyor is, you know, on the hook professionally for it, so they're not just going to go, oh, right then, God, I'll do you a favor, because, you know, ultimately the bank or building society could go back to that surveyor and say, you overvalued this property. We've now had to repossess this property. We've now discovered this property is worth much less than it was. Come on, sunshine. And that surveyor will find themselves in trouble. I mean, but you've got a scenario where, because the market is weak, people are putting their houses on the market potentially for more money than they think they'll sell for, allowing for a bit of wriggle room for people to negotiate a discount. Now, in some cases, that might be allowing for people to negotiate 10 grand off, but in other cases, it might be allowing for people to negotiate 50 grand off. Again, on the podcast last week, we were talking about mortgage rates. I mean, I live in commuter belt Hertfordshire, where four bedroom detached family homes regularly go on the market for like for £1 million. And I'm seeing houses go on the market, and then 2 weeks later, they have 100 grand chopped off the price, which is, you know, 10% of their asking price. So people might put them on at 1.1. I think, well, you know, if we get somebody through the door, you know, maybe we get a couple of people through the door who are interested. They might bid against each other. Maybe we'll get close to it. At least it gives us a bit of money to chop off, because people are going to expect at least 50 grand off. And then they don't get anybody through the door, so they chop price down to a million, take 10% off it. You know, that, I mean, that's not common, but it's not unusual. And you can see this kind of stuff actually. A really good tip for people who are buying is you can get a couple of plugins for Chrome where you can look at Rightmove and you can track what has happened to asking prices. So Rightmove will tell you if a property has had its price reduced, but it won't tell you how much it's had it reduced by. Largely because Rightmove makes its money from estate agents paying a subscription fee, and estate agents do not want Rightmove publishing that. However, there are a couple of trackers that track Rightmove, and so they will show you. There's one called Property Log and there's one called Property Tracker. Look them up and you'll be able to see when you look at those Rightmove listings, oh, here's what it started at. Here's what it is now. This is what the percentage cut is. But to go back to what people can do, as I said, get all of your information together and then you go back to your building society or your bank and you say, we think that you have undervalued this property. Your alternative is also you go back to the seller. And this gives you quite a lot of ammunition because you say, well, we've agreed to buy your home for X, but our bank or building society has told us that it is only worth Y. We cannot buy your home for X because we cannot borrow the money to do so, but we would be willing to buy it for Y, the lower price. Because if we don't do that, we're going to have to put more money into it ourselves, or it might change our loan to value and we might not be able to afford the mortgage anymore. And you're going to have a piece of paper that shows you that a professional has said that house is only worth this. And so it, you know, becomes a good negotiating tool. Now, the seller might tell you to do one. They might have somebody else who is interested in buying it. Or alternatively, the seller might have found somewhere that they want to move to and they just want to get their house sold because, frankly, they just want to get their house sold and they want to move. That was the whole point of them putting the house up for sale in the first place. And they might say, okay, well, you know, maybe we'll take the hit. And maybe they can go to the person they're buying off and say, well, look, we've had a down valuation on ours, so we need to get a bit of money off. And actually, if you can take a bit of money off all the way up the chain to the top, then everybody saves money apart from the person at the top. And the person at the top is going to be the person who's likely to have made the most money anyway. So quite often they might just be willing to take a hit because maybe they're of that generation that bought that £1 million four-bed detached family home for £70,000 in the 80s. So £930,000 of it is profit.
Yeah, maybe. But then they probably have to look for somewhere else, though.
Well, they're having to give money to their kids so that they can try and buy the homes.
Exactly. That's true. Right. Sticking with property, bungalows. Making a comeback, not just for the elderly and the downsizers. Young families, first-time buyers also increasingly interested, and as a result, prices are soaring. There's even a makeover trend thing going on. I've not seen it, but apparently there is, on TikTok and Instagram about bungalows. Lee, I'm in a parallel universe here. I thought bungalows are really passé.
Not fallen down the bungalow TikTok rabbit hole. Oh, Georgie, what are you doing with your life?
I mean, I know.
Yeah, I was quite surprised to read that. But actually, in a way, I'm not, because we've spoken about this before. And I remember doing a story a couple of years back or something quite similar, just how quickly bungalows are selling compared to other property types. And it happens around here. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but there's a whole road near me full of bungalows. One goes up for sale and it's sold within days. Or typically, that's what happens. And they get renovated. They see skips outside and quite often then given a sort of like bit of a grey facade. You know what I mean by that? It's sort of like really greyed up. You know, a bit of Essex-ness here going on to try and make them look a bit more trendy. But it's a lot of younger buyers that are interested in these, which typically a bungalow, really, the selling point is for older people
who don't
want to use the stairs anymore. You know, that's kind of what the functionality of a bungalow is. And again, I think I've said this on the podcast before. How many bungalows do we know that are getting built at the moment compared to other property types? I mean, basically, developers are building detached homes or semi-detached homes on the whole. I mean, should there be a quota of bungalows that go up on a new development? Well, that's open for interpretation, but I actually think that there is a argument to be said that they should be, you know, smaller one, two bed bungalows in new build estates, because, you know, where are older people meant to live if they want to downsize? But look, that's an argument for another day.
The problem isn't unless you ring fence them off for older people, because at the minute you've got people who want them for holiday lets, you've got young families.
Well, you can. You say sometimes when you are surfing around, stuff is.
And disabled people as well, let's say that, not just elderly.
Are available to certain buyers. But going on the stats of this story, the price of bungalows is up 22% on average since the pandemic, compared to 15% for all types of property across the UK. That's according to Hamptons. Bungalows now typically sell for £362,445. The average gain on a bungalow sold last year was £102,000, according to Zillow.
Wow.
equivalent of £13,100 a year. That's a greater gain than any other property type other than detached homes. And basically, estate agents are saying young professionals in their 20s and 30s are entering bidding wars against pensioners for these homes. Now, one of the reasons for that is that they quite often have a slightly cheaper asking price. Often, more often than not, they're detached. Sometimes semi-detached property, for example, which is probably a relatively similar price point, can put some people off sometimes. You know, would it be completely solitary without anyone either side of you? And the number of them for sale and the number of them that are out there hasn't really increased that much. So one estate agent based in the Midlands said bungalows are like hen's teeth because there aren't that many of them, yet they are hardly sought after. Downsizers don't want to compromise on space, and strong anti-leasehold feeling is also pushing them away from flats. So it's squeezing people into these bungalows. And also, single-story living actually, it does open itself and lend itself to open plan living. And open plan living is kind of, I sometimes think the younger generation have kind of ideas of like, you know, like Australia, for example, where there's a lot of open living, lot of kind of open space, and you open the doors out to the garden and things, and it's all kind of smooth and autonomous. Where sometimes houses, they can be quite poorly designed. Even houses that are not that old sometimes could be quite poorly designed. Whereas with a bungalow, you have a bit more scope to kind of gut it inside and out without the kind of thought process of where does the stairs go, for example. But saying that, so many bungalows down this road that I'm talking about near me, this fabled road that I'm talking about near me, have extensions put into them where they're built into the roof, and then they're no longer bungalows anymore.
Well, I was going to say, is that... So I've got lots of questions about this. One, Lee, I am on Google right now looking at grey bungalows. Mm-hmm. And there's a real vibe of, Australia, New Zealand, American porches. But the thing with Australia and America, certainly, not so much New Zealand, but they've got fewer people, is they're a big place. Yeah, it's a big country. We're not so big, so I can see why that's not that useful here and why it's not so popular. Simon wanted to jump in there and get in on the bungalow debate, you know?
Yes. And I mean, I can give a little bit of insight into some of this stuff, having bought something that was not a bungalow, but would potentially have been described as a chalet style home, i.e. it had two bedrooms upstairs, but two bedrooms downstairs, on the basis that we were going to extend it and do a load of work on it.
Which was my next question. Are people just buying these so that they can build up and across?
So this is a huge amount of the attraction to do with this for people who aren't necessarily the downsizers. The downsizers quite often, just as Lee said, they want a place on one story. But like, what is a bungalow? Define your bungalow, because you've got bungalows which are just on one floor, right? You've got chalet bungalows, which is a bungalow with a room in the roof, so you might have one bedroom upstairs or two bedrooms upstairs, and then you've got something that you might get described as a chalet style home, which is what our house was. We always described it as a triangle house. So basically, you've got the downstairs, which is, you know, the ground floor, normal walls, and then the upstairs is all the timber frame. So in our case, it had originally one triangle, and you had two bedrooms upstairs and a bathroom. And there was two bedrooms downstairs. And we bought the house from the people who bought it in 1962, brand new, the couple who bought it. So it's kind of very much as the 60s left it. They'd done a small extension, but they hadn't done a big extension. A lot of places have had big extensions done on them. The attraction with bungalows themselves, or chalet style bungalows, is that people think it's going to be cheaper and easier to do the work, because the roof height tends to be reasonably high on a bungalow, although you've only got, you know, living space downstairs, and even on a chalet bungalow you've got like one room upstairs. But if you add some dormers, you can extend the upstairs. So it's quite easy to turn a chalet bungalow that's got one bedroom upstairs into a house that's got three bedrooms upstairs, maybe even four bedrooms upstairs. It's where you start to see lots of dormers coming out of roofs and things like that. Or even with a normal bungalow, it's quite often quite easy to get a couple of rooms upstairs. what we did was with ours was we added another triangle and then bridged between it. So we took it, so it's got four bedrooms upstairs, and then the whole of the downstairs then becomes living space. So you end up with quite a lot of living space. What you need to be careful about, though, is the cost of building at the moment. The cost of building at the moment is very, very high. And actually, potentially, materials as well factor into this, to the point where it may not be cheaper for you to do this than it is to either just do a traditional extension or actually just to buy a home that's already done. Because if you start, what people want to do quite often is they want to build out downstairs to create their big open plan kitchen, dining, seating area. So they've got the expense of building the walls outstairs. That's then going to need a roof on it. And even if you put a flat roof on it, there's a cost there. And then you've got the expense of doing the work inside and the roof work, and it all starts to add up. And you might find that because bungalows are in such hot demand and people are going into bidding wars for them, and estate agents are pricing them so high and the cost of building work is so high, that after you've gone to all of that trouble and all of that effort, you haven't actually made any money. Mm. And you might have been better off just buying a house that's already done. Mm. Although you do get a house, you know, to your spec. So who knows? But it is, a lot of it is to do with the fact that you're getting a house that you think is easier to extend and cheaper to extend. And also it tends to be on a decent sized plot. Because as Lee said, nobody's building bungalows anymore, mm-hmm. or hardly any, which means that the bungalows that you do find are from an era when people built new houses with enough garden, which is what the problem is with new houses now, is you don't get enough garden and they need to make the maximum amount of space. So we don't want to build a bungalow. We need to fit as much stuff into that footprint as possible. And we squeeze that garden as small as we can. And maybe we cut the corners on how good it and is built and how well it's built. And then we suddenly find that people don't want to buy these new built homes.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now for our weekly Financial Planning Explained feature with Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct. Lisa, welcome to the podcast. I have a question here from a listener. I'm a higher rate taxpayer and I paid £5,000 into my SIP in March, but don't have to do a self-assessment tax return. How do I claim my full tax relief?
Great question. The basic rate of tax relief will be reclaimed for you by the pension, but the higher rate, you'll have to contact His Majesty's Revenue and Customs, HMRC, to get back the higher rate of tax relief. It doesn't happen automatically. How you get it is effectively through paying less tax.
And will they have to wait until next year to get the money back from the tax man?
You can contact HMRC now and let them know what you've done, and they'll take that into account. And it may be that you don't have to do a self-assessment, but you don't actually get money in your pocket. How it works is tax relief, so you pay less tax, and that's how it works.
Okay, Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Energy firms have been trying to push smart meters on us for years. Have they uncovered, though, a new trick to get us to make the swap? One, This Is Money reader is certainly asking the question. Our electric and gas company, Scottish Power, have said that our meters have come to the end of their life expectancy. As a result, they must be replaced by smart meters. Is there anything we can do? We really don't want a smart meter. Hey, boys, why would energy firms want us to have smart meters?
I don't think this is anything that new, if I'm being honest with you, Georgie, right? We've had this kind of thread for quite a while now. Traditional meter is going out of date. You're going to need it replaced. We're not replacing your traditional meter. You're going to need a smart meter. Now, energy companies want you to have a smart meter because there's government targets for the amount of smart meters that need to be installed into people's homes. And it's easier for energy companies to keep track of your energy usage. And therefore, they argue that it will give you more accurate bills if you're with a smart meter, have a smart meter. Now, I've had this a few years ago. I was told that one of my traditional meters that live on the outside of the house had come to the end of its life, 10 years old, end of its life. Okay, fair enough. Doesn't seem that old to me. And it was working fine. But they went on and on and on about me replacing it with a smart meter. Until eventually I did phone them up, speak to them, and I said, I don't want a smart meter, I want it replaced with a traditional meter. Lots of grumbling, lots of sort of like, you know, are you sure you want to do that? And eventually they replaced it with another traditional meter. Now, in that time since, that was with Shell Energy, which has recently been taken over by Optimus. I've now been told that the other meter is 10 years old and it needs replacing, and it will need to be replaced with a smart meter. I haven't bothered to get back in touch and sort all this out because, again, it's working fine, and it's one of those things where I'm like, no, just like you're going to stick it down the line. Which then gets me onto this case, saying that it's come to the end of its life and it's typically between 15 and 20 years. So I feel like I've got another 10 years in this meter yet before it needs replacing. But it just feels like one of those kind of things where it's like, oh, it's 10 years old. We're going to tell this customer that you're going to need a smart meter to replace this. Now, we were previously told, and I've been told this, that you don't have to have a smart meter, i.e., they have to replace your traditional meter if you request it. Most people, a lot of people are happy they're smart meters. They think the smart meters do a great job. They make their lives easier, don't have to take readings. Other people think it's an invasion of privacy, do not want every half an hour meter readings going, and think it's some sort of massive conspiracy in which energy will be charged at different rates at different times. Wherever you sit in that debate, I think it's your right in your household to pick how you want your energy delivered and monitored. What we're seeing now, more of this year for definite, going by our post bag, are energy firms essentially saying that they're not going to be replacing traditional meters anymore. It has to be a smart meter, arguing that lots of companies aren't even building traditional meters anymore. All feels a little bit smoke and mirrors. I'm going to be honest with you. The report, Ang Howard Carrick, who wrote this story, we had a big discussion about this week, where I think it's time for Ofgem to kind of give us the answers to all of this. We need almost like a guide of this is what I've been told. What are the actual rules? Because it feels at the moment that things were pretty straightforward and pretty cut and dry, but it feels like the goalpost has been shifted somewhat. And I kind of want to know what the answer is, if I'm being quite frank with you. Like, you know, what is the actual answer? Is what Scottish Power and other energy companies, not just Scottish Power, saying correct? That you they they're under no obligation to replace your traditional meter, because if that's true, there's going to be quite a lot of uproar from certain people that do not want smart meters. And just to give you a flavor of this, Georgie, because you might be listening to this and you might be someone that's got a smart meter and you might be thinking, come on, just get a smart meter. But if you read our comments, if you read our the email correspondence that we get, and the kind of flavor of the people that are kind of angry about this, there's a large chunk of people that just do not want smart meters, and
Why?
that is
What's
their
the common
choice.
reason, Lou?
I think the common reason
Privacy or
is the privacy. I think it's
right?
the kind of constant monitoring of, you know, it's like a device inside your household that it's not exactly spying on you, but it knows you your habits from a half hourly basis of how much energy and gas you use. And for some people, they just don't like the sound of that. You know, they don't like this constant creep of things coming into their homes that it feels like it makes the life easier for the supplier, but does it make the life easier for the person in the household? And lots of people will just say, no, it doesn't really. I don't need it. It's, you know, is it really going to save me pounds and pence, as they always say in the adverts? It realistically. And a lot of people will say, no, it won't. Now, you can get a smart meter and turn it into dumb mode. Some suppliers allow you to do that, which basically just means it takes readings here and there, rather than it constantly giving you updated sort of usage as you go along. But I don't know, George, it's a big question to be asked here. It's a very, 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 very hot topic with our readers. I mean, it is one of those kind of like button pushing sort of trigger topics, if I'm being honest, about kind of this push for everyone to have smart meters. And you know, there's been a vast cost on how much this has added on to people's energy bills as well, over the years. The rollout of it, I would argue, has been an exercise and a case study in how not to roll something out like this.
So, Lee, if you don't know, what advice can you give your reader?
Well, we obviously went to Scottish Power and saying that they said Scottish Power, as with all suppliers, are obligated to replace all traditional meters with smart meters by the industry regulator Ofgem.
Installed meters come with a certified life from manufacturers, and suppliers monitor and record each meter on an ongoing basis to track where they're coming to the end of their certified life, which is typically between 15 and 20 years. And this can vary between based on the type of meter. And then went on to say, you know, smart meters have got benefits, blah, 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 blah. Where you go next from this is, it again, another question that we need to put to Ofgem and a follow-up on this, because if you just flat refuse to have the smart meter, I actually don't know. I reckon there could be an argument that the supplier would say, we don't want you as a customer anymore. We can't have you anymore. Because I think that's where this inevitably could go. And then you will be constantly scrabbling around for the suppliers that will offer you a traditional meter over a smart meter. But yeah, there are definitely some more questions that are raised in this case. As I said before, it felt quite cut and dry. Best of my knowledge, I was told that a traditional meter had to be replaced if requested, and you didn't need a smart meter. Now we're starting to get some kind of excuses as to why that can't be done, aka traditional meters aren't being made anymore, and Ofgem is making us. That's what the kind of vibe we're getting off of the kind of correspondence we've been getting. I would say in the last 6 months, this is where it's been ramped up. It feels like suppliers are really, really going for it. And if you think about it, a company like Octopus, who've taken over Shell, they've taken over Bulb, millions more customers have come on board. Octopus is a very, very tech savvy business. Mm. It has tech at front and center of what it does. Traditional meters get in the way of that. They get in the way of, you know, the smart meter for Octopus is what they want probably each customer to have, to make their lives easier. So now it's got millions of customers, and a big slab of those customers, including myself, haven't got a smart meter. And probably don't want a smart meter. So where do they go next? And also, a lot of people that would have joined Octopus would have joined Octopus because they like the tech savvy stuff. They've got something called Kraken, which is their kind of platform. Very intuitive, very AI heavy. You know, it's got a lot going for it. A lot of people that have signed up to Octopus have signed up for good customer service, and they've signed up because they're happy with the tech and they're happy to have their readings taken all the time, and to use smart meters. They're engaged with it. They're engaged with the app. They get rewards, all of that kind of thing. They've now hoovered up millions more customers who haven't chosen to go and move to Octopus and might not fit that criteria. And then it's like, is that now dragging down their total percentage of the amount of people that have got a smart meter, and do they need to ramp it up? The reason why I'm mentioning Octopus here is that we've had quite a few reader emails about Octopus as well. And we're looking into all of this, Georgie, and it will be something that will continue to rumble on in the coming months, if not years.
I was going to say, if anyone can find out, it's you guys, Lee. It's you guys. Right, and finally, good news for JD Weatherspoon. The No Frills pub chain said it expects annual profit to come in towards the top end of forecast. The people of Britain love it, but do Simon and Lee? In the style of a school debating meet, please, gentlemen, Lee, would you take the floor on Weatherspoons?
Quickly, before I do, can we just give you another lift the curtain moment?
Okay.
So essentially, obviously, it was a bank holiday Monday, and I was back from paternity leave on Tuesday. So I'd been off for a couple of weeks. So I was chomping at the bit, Georgie, to get back into the office and to, you know, get editing and get writing and all that kind of stuff. Now, on Wednesday, Simon and I, one of us will sort of lift our head over the parapet of the computer screen and say, do you want me to write the newsletter message? So we have a newsletter that goes out on a Thursday, and we write it on Wednesday, obviously in ready to go out with the newsletter. So I poked my head over the screen and said, do you want me to write the newsletter, Simon? To which Simon said, yeah, okay, cool. Have you got, what are you going to do it on? And I was like, don't know. Weatherspoons has had some sort of quite good results today. Mm. And you do know I love a Weatherspoons. What about if I do a kind of piece on how much I like Weatherspoons? And then Simon just turned around and said, I hate Weatherspoons. And there we go. That's how this all came out.
That genius.
I mean, hate might be a bit of a strong word. I'm putting words maybe into Simon's mouth here. Maybe he'll see what you'll see what I mean by that. But I kind of then was like,
take the floor, Lee.
I was like, I'm going to need 10 things that I love about Weatherspoons in order to make this work. 10 things. I managed to write 15 down in about 1 minute. So look, the thing is with Weatherspoons is you know what you're going to get. It's like a comfy pair of slippers. You know, yep. You're going to slip in. It's non-pretentious. The staff are always good. The app is good as well when you sit at the table and get it in. The drinks are cheap. They're cheaper than anywhere else, and it helps keep the cost low at pubs around it. And don't get me wrong, I love visiting all the pubs around the one in my local Rady High Street in called the Roebuck. There's plenty of other pubs around that I'll go and frequent, but Wetherspoons has a special place in my heart. It really does. Like, it has lots of venues that are unusual and quirky and have been saved from wreck and ruin. The food's not great. It's not exactly like gourmet experience, but it does a job when you've had a few beers, in my opinion. There's nowhere else you're getting a pack of dry roasted peanuts for 75p in the southeast. If there is, please do let me know. And I think the thing is with Wetherspoons, when I was a bit younger, the argument was the atmosphere wasn't all that great, and you'd go in and it was just full of old blokes drinking their 99PLs and all that kind of stuff. I think it's shifted a lot in recent years. It's a much younger clientele because, you know, I hate the cost of living crisis sort of mantra, but the cost of pub crisis is definitely real. You know, and that's why I think a lot of the younger generation just don't drink, or they don't really go out and socialise in the same way as that how we did. But you go to Wetherspoons, especially on a Friday, Saturday, the one near me is always absolutely rammed, and it is rammed with a mix of people, and the atmosphere is good. Much better than the atmosphere used to be in Wetherspoons. The refill coffees, the refill hot drinks, I mean, what an absolute touch for pensioners, especially, you know, £1.56 in my local Wetherspoons for unlimited coffee refill.
Random figure.
There's quite a lot of random figures at Wetherspoons. Right. Don't question it. The random figures may be another reason why I quite like it. You never quite know what to expect. But £1.56, if you're a pensioner, especially, you know, and you still want to socialise and you go and meet your friend down Wetherspoons for breakfast and you're paying £1.56 and you get three or four coffees out of that. I mean, a latte now is about £3.50. I mean, it could be even more than that, £4. And then don't get me started with some of the pubs pricing at the moment.
It's outrageous.
A pub near us in Kensington, right? Yeah, Kensington, one of the most expensive places in the country, and of course it is. There's no Wetherspoons. You are paying now £7 to £8 a pint. That is, I think that's galling. It's absolutely galling. I'd much rather at the moment just go down the shop and buy a couple of tins and take them over to the park now the weather's better. That kind of price is, I think, absolutely... Where do you draw a line? So when I go to Wetherspoons, when I come back to Essex, you will find me sometimes in the Roebuck or the Blue Boar in Billericay, which has a nice garden. You know, I don't break a £10 note sometimes for the prices. You know, a couple of quid a pint, you have a few pints, pack of nuts, lovely. Yeah. I even love its big, chunky magazine, Georgie, when you go through it. And there's a myriad of stories. It's so chunky.
Your time is drawing to a close. All right, you know? Okay. We're going to make this fair. Three minutes each. I sign off with
two last things. There's not a better place to eavesdrop on people's conversations. It's a journalist's dream. There's so many conversations. Politicians should spend a lot of time in Wetherspoons to gauge what the mood music of the entire nation, because you hear all sorts. And I have been to many, I would say, probably what you would class as the best bars in the world, exotic bars, expensive cocktails, all of that kind of stuff. But even if I became a multi-millionaire, Georgie, I would never abandon Spoons. Ever.
That's it.
I think it's great. There we go. I'm signed out. Boom.
Absolutely. I did enjoy that, because I was going to say the clientele are what makes it. But I won't make any opinion yet. Simon, the floor is yours.
I don't hate Wetherspoons. I like Wetherspoons. I like that Wetherspoons exists. I like it as a business. I like it as an option. I like it as a British cultural phenomenon. But you will only ever find me going into Wetherspoons under duress.
I was going to say, for the toilet?
And the last time I went into Wetherspoons, it was under duress. And the person applying said duress was none other than Mr. Lee Boyce. We went for a drink before a Christmas party over in Holborn last year. What should we do? Should we go for a drink in Kensington by the office and then go over there? Or should we go get a pint before we go in, a sharpener before we go into the Christmas party? experience told us that what we should not do was go for a drink in Kensington before we travelled to where we were meant to be going to, because we've done this a lot before. And what it ends up with is a bunch of us in the pub in Kensington for way longer than we're meant to be going, we really need to leave. We really need to leave. We were meant to be there an hour ago. Should we get another drink and then leave? So we arrive in Holborn. Now, Holborn is a part of London that's blessed with loads of old pubs, old London pubs, tucked down corners and alleyways, or with like ornate bits inside, you know, classic pubs. So I was like, let's go into one. There's one called the Ship Tavern, just around the back of the station. We go in there. It's a bit busy, but it's got that December London pub vibe. It's got little corners, nooks and crannies. We have a pint, find ourselves a spot. It's a bit awkward where we're standing, you know, people are going past and everything, but it's not so bad. Should we get another round in? Nah, it's too awkward where we're standing. Let's go to the Wetherspoons down the road. Now, I'd already vetoed the Wetherspoons once and managed to get them into the Ship Tavern. And I do feel that it's only fair for other people to have their pub say, you know. So I was like, all right, fine. So we left the kind of London pub that you'd send someone visiting London to. Go in there. It's a classic London pub. For a cavernous drinking barn down the road, the Shakespeare's Head, the Wetherspoons. You know, which was great. It was cheap. It had lots of people having a nice time in it. It had an atmosphere, but it wasn't the same. And that's what I feel about the Wetherspoons. It's not the same. I love pubs. I absolutely love pubs. I love the weird Britishness of the pub. I love the vibe of the pub. I've only ever been into one pub in my life that I thought I am never coming back in here. And that was more to do with the wolf stroke massive pub dog that was wandering around that I was very concerned if I made a wrong move would eat me. Interestingly, that pub, the Bedford Tavern on the Seven Sisters Road, I'm talking about 20, 25 years back now, it's now been turned into a trendy craft beer pub because the area has been gentrified, but hey ho, that's how it goes. Now, my concern is that the pubs are closing in this country at an alarming rate. And I think that you should try to frequent them and support them. And I like an individual pub. You wouldn't find me in another big chain pub either. I don't like, you know, the big Enterprise Inn ones. I don't even like the big out-of-town Marston's ones that feel a bit soulless. Even ones where they try to sort of make it look like a traditional country pub. I've been in one of those once where they took the traditional country pub that we used to drink in when we were teenagers, and then they countrified it. And we were sitting in there, me and a friend, and he said, where do you think they get all this crap they stick on the walls? Like the old, you know, hose and vintage bits of farming equipment and the jugs and stuff. He's like, look at this. And he picked it up, lifted it up off the wall, and he went, it's still got the price tag underneath it. So there are places that sell that. I like the traditional, more independent. You can spot the landlady or the landlord. You can spot the regulars. You can sit there, watch the world go by. I like that kind of pub. And there's still enough of them open that I would rather go seek one of those out, even if the end result of it is a bit patchy for its character and its individualism, than I would decide to go to a Wetherspoons. And it's not because I'm a pub snob, just to be clear, because I have been accused of that. And as I was writing my half of this column, I thought I'm going to sound like a massive snob here. But it's not because I'm a pub snob. It's actually because I'm not a pub snob. It's because I genuinely believe that you should head into those weird backstreet boozers because you're never going to know when you're going to find a decent one. And like in my I'm not a pub snob defense, my first journalism job was in Luton. I spent 2.5 years working in Luton and I frequented some absolute dives of pubs in Luton. But I tell you what, some of them you walked into with very low expectations and they turned out to be an absolute gem. And right. That's another place where I used to regularly get forced under duress by my colleagues into the bloody Wetherspoons. And I was like, come on, guys, there's so many like really weird, quirky pubs in this town. Let's stop going to the Wetherspoons. So that's my line of argument.
All right, then. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm going to sit somewhere in the middle here, which I think is technically what you did there, Simon. Firstly, I don't think the demise of the Great British Pub is related to Wetherspoons. I think it's got a lot to do with the breweries, to be fair. Pints are ridiculously priced. You do get the regulars in Wetherspoons, that's for sure. I don't think one cannibalises the other. I think it's a different, dare I use the word, experience. If you're going to a Wetherspoons as to if you were going to a nice nook and cranny back of the wherever pub. The problem I see with a lot of pubs is they're all turning into gastro restaurant pubs. Went in the other day, couldn't even take the dog. Ridiculous prices. Ouch. I mean, I don't want some arty-farty dinner. I just want to go and get some scampi and chips, you know? At least with the Wetherspoons, you get that. Might be microwaved, but that's fine. So actually, I'm going to give this award, saying all that to Lee. Congratulations, Lee. You've taken the award for, I don't know what this is, Wetherspoons. Yeah. The vouchers are in the post. That blew my mind. You can give people the gift of Wetherspoons in a voucher form for their birthday. Maybe that's it for your new little one, Lee. I mean, not for the little one. They're a bit young to drink, but you can have it. Some vouchers from Wetherspoons.
You don't even need to give me the vouchers, Georgie. I could just go and find a table with my local Wetherspoons. You can get the app and you can just, you know,
yes,
that sensation of people putting their table number up on social media and loads of random stuff comes to the table. I mean, what a place, Georgie. What a place.
I know. It is legendary. The app is really good.
And I love how weirdly, quirkly British that whole randomly sending people stuff in Wetherspoons is. But why would you want your pub to have an app, for God's sake? You know, this is my point. You know,
I
prefer the kind of pub. And I told this story to the bar. I told this story to Lee and Helen the other day. I prefer the kind of pub that's got a pub coat that they lend you. So we went over to our local pub. I'm really lucky to have a really great local pub. It's a country pub in Hertfordshire called the Elephant and Castle. It's a 15-minute walk across the fields from my house, and it's my local. We were over there one time, me and my wife and our kids, my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law and their kids. And I'd gone over, and I think it was a bank holiday, but it was one of those times of year where the weather's lovely and it's really warm in the daytime, but you totally underestimate how much colder it's going to get once it drops and the sun goes down. And this might have been in the kind of COVID era where you weren't allowed in the pub if you weren't from the same household or whatever. So we had to be in the garden.
Right.
So we go over there, sun goes down. I'm wearing shorts, t-shirt, espadrilles. I'm not dressed for the weather. I'm getting colder and colder to the point where I got the little pushchair cover from in my niece's pushchair and I had it around my shoulders like a little kind of scarf thing.
You could have just walked home.
It wasn't really covering that much of me. I mean, we were having a great time.
Right.
I know what it was. It was COVID era. This was the one time I took advantage of Eat Out to Help Out. We decided, because it was still running, it was the August bank holiday. We were like, oh, we could do that. We could save a load of money on it. Anyway, the landlord came out, looked at me wearing my little pushchair cover around my shoulders and said, you warm enough there? I was like, no, it's bloody freezing. And he arrived back a couple of minutes later. He said, here, you can put this on. It's the pub coat.
Yeah.
It's the random coat that they have hanging up in the pub. And he took it.
Presumably someone had left it there.
Yeah, someone had left it there ages ago. And people could just borrow it as the pub coat. And he brought it out, gave me the
marvelous
pub coat.
Right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, your views on Wetherspoons. Simon.
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Put podcast in the subject line. Tweet us at thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy, cost effective, and flexible. Using our website or app, with our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.